Thank you all for making it here this afternoon. As I think Christian mentioned, it's kind of the, we're calling it kind of the work of the village this week, the avalanche training. The village, as you'll learn, and I don't know how much people have experience with avalanches, but we are in the valley here. We do have a number of avalanche chutes, and typical winters we have a fair amount of avalanche activity. So it's a basic educational program that's really good to have here. So thank you, and there'll be sessions today, tomorrow afternoon, and I think on Thursday. It's on the schedule. But I'd like to start, though, by introducing Roland Emmetas, Mr. M, who Mr. M could explain, or he will explain probably better, but he was one of the originating founders of the Northwest Avalanche Center and a career Forest Service person who came here when we had a wildfire a number of years ago and got connected with the village and has been teaching avalanche training every winter probably since then, since about 2004. And so we're very honored to have him here. This is the second time this winter, and I know that you'll really enjoy the workshop here. So introduce Mr. M.
Thank you, Chuck. Well, first of all, I want to expand a little bit on Chuck's comments about the location of the village. It's a scary place. There's avalanche paths all sides. There's an avalanche path that crosses the road on the way up. You remember, I think maybe the driver contacted the office here and said there, what's the name of that slide?
The Narrows.
There's Old Faithful, but there's about 17.
Yeah. So the driver lets the staff know here when they're crossing those paths. Actually, when there's avalanche conditions, the driver wears an avalanche beacon in case the driver has to get out of the bus to fix a chain or something and an avalanche comes down so we can find the driver. So I worry about this village. I'm not trying to scare you, but I do worry. And the other concern I have, and you already heard it at the briefings, safety briefing on the bus, are the roof avalanches. One year, I think it was 3 years ago, we drove up from Lucerne, stopped at the village entrance. We had the briefing, mentioned roof avalanches, started up again, came to the loading dock, and that whole roof of the building that we just went through released onto the roadway. So, did I get your attention a little bit? Okay. So, a little bit about me. I was born a long time ago in New Jersey. And I wanted to be a meteorologist. And heck, I could hardly pass algebra in high school. So I looked at the curriculum for meteorology. There was calculus and all kinds of things in it. Said that wasn't for me. So I took forestry instead. My freshman year at Penn State, I got a summer job in the Northwest. And I've been here ever since. Is that enough history? I worked 38 years with the Forest Service, primarily in wildland recreation management. And I've been retired for a while. So, I think what I'll do, a couple of things right off the bat. I have about four or five reasons people get caught in avalanches. And these are people that are knowledgeable. They're professionals. They could be professionals in the avalanche field, professionals in guiding service, whatever. So one reason is poor personal decision making. I mean, we all have that issue. Loss of situational awareness, poor communication. I'm sure you're your teachers in school talk about communication all the time, communication, communication. We all need to communicate. And then another reason is making assumptions based on past data or experience. You know, just because we did it one way before doesn't mean it's going to be the same way today. So just a few little comments. The reasons for accidents. Avalanche Education Northwest. I sort of represent the Northwest Avalanche Center.
What's that green spot?
What?
What's that green spot you were showing?
It's from his
pointer.
And also represent the Northwest Weather. The Forest Service manages the Northwest Weather and Avalanche Center. The forecasters are Forest Service employees that work in the Weather Service Forecast Office at Sandpoint in Seattle. So, as maybe you heard last night, I mentioned this is Avalanche Awareness 101. And when you leave this room, it's very, very basic. When you leave this room, you'll know nothing about avalanches. Because when you're out there in the snow doesn't know you went to Mr. M's training. And also, as we go through this, if you have any questions, hey, Mr. M, I don't understand what you're talking about. And do it loud, I can't hear. Okay, so, I'll go back. I got some aneurysms. And one is when you dance. Oh, a lot of things I'm going to talk about just don't apply to being out in the snow. It apply to everything you do in life. A lot of the safety issues, a lot of safety concerns I talk about apply walking down the street, driving a car, whatever. So, one aneurysm is when you dance with the mountains always lead. Okay? So, you know, prepare for the worst, expect the best. Technology is cool, but experience is better. Never be complacent, even if you've done it 100 times before. And I'll talk a lot about, later on, about human factors. Most of us think we are smarter than we are, right? Does that ring a bell a little bit? Okay. And I'm really gonna be hard on the guys in the room because they're the ones that get killed. And so I got some philosophies about men and women, you may agree or not. Generally, women are more cooperative, nurturing, cautious, and emotionally responsive, while guys tend to be more competitive, assertive, reckless, and emotionally flat, at least in our culture. And it can vary, it doesn't mean everyone's that way, but generally. So, another M-ism is good judgment. Oh, we already talked about that. Everyone's always looking for the single thing, a pill to solve whatever issue they have. Like I saw here recently, a pill you could, it was advertised on the radio, a good day pill. A pill you could take to have a good day. You know, there's pills you can take to grow your eyelashes, there's pills for all kinds of things. Well, going out in the snow, there's no single clue out there to tell you whether a particular slope is safe or not. There's a whole bunch of things you need to do. There's a whole bunch of clues to look at. There's some low stability tests that you might want to do, and we'll demonstrate all these in the presentation. Your professors probably won't agree with this, but I feel it's better to be inaccurate and correct than precise and wrong. Another one I have is, and this applies to no matter what you're doing, walking, traveling out on the snow, or driving a car, travel with laser-like focus, but have flood-like awareness. So apply that to driving. Focus on your driving, but be checking your mirrors every 5 to 8 seconds. Follow me? This is sort of a guy thing. Sometimes their minds write checks that their body can't cash.
I'm making
pancakes. Maybe you already have a feeling of what the profile of a typical avalanche victim. What do you think? Male or female?
Male.
How old do you think this male is?
18 to 25.
18 to 25. 34. Actually older. And in fact, they're getting older. It seems like, I think I mentioned last night, the more experience people have, the more training they have, the more risk they take. So right now, as of last year's accidents, there were 24 fatalities in the United States last year from avalanche. The average age is about 36. So, do we have a 36-year-old male in the room? Someone's going to have to speak up because I'll find whoever's closest. So, anyone 30?
Wally? I'm four.
What's this? So, how old are you?
23.
Oh, just a kid.
What's this?
So, anyone closer to 36 than 23?
26.
Oh, 26? Anyone closer? Okay, you're it. So what's your name?
Brian.
Do you remember Brian's name?
Sure.
I forget. Okay. Okay, there's some handouts that you can pick up after. A little brochure, very basic, avalanche safety. Another one that you could practice, if some of you are going to go out on skis or snowshoes, you might remember some of these little quick stability tests you can do, which are very simple and easy to explain. We're going to talk about stability tests, and unfortunately we aren't going to be able to try any of them out in the snow because we don't have enough snow here, but we will demonstrate them in class. I'll find three people that will volunteer to be snow collars. So that. Another one that I'm going to talk quite a bit about is human factors. So take at your leisure, read this little write-up on human factors. And finally, I have this finish over checklist. Checklist is on a sheet. This is revised. It's a draft form. The original checklist has too much stuff on it. If you're interested, I got it on some plastic cards, but I'm trying to revise it, have less on the card so people can read it. The print's so small, people complain they can't read it. And on the back of the checklist is your quiz. You didn't know you were going to get a quiz. So Wednesday you'll have the quiz. But the questions are here. Okay. So, what was his name?
Brian.
Brian. Okay. A little bit about the photos, a little bit about my presentation. I took most of the photos that are in this presentation. I wasn't here at Mount Baker when these two women took off out on the snow. It was taken in 1938, but I thought they were pretty cool. They had heavy-duty ski gear, heavy-duty wool clothing, but the thing that caught me were their eyes. And that's what I'm going to try to do with you. You probably look at the snow with skier's eyes or Midwest eyes, but you probably don't look at the snow with avalanche eyes. And that's what I'm going to try to help you develop your avalanche eyes. So remember the two ladies. We're out there doing all kinds of things. Winter mountaineering. There's more of us out there than there used to be. I copied a photo on a calendar. It's apparently some kind of Nordic event in the Engadine Valley near St. Moritz, Switzerland. Huge group of skiers. There's more of us than there used to be, and some of us get off the flat ground and expose ourselves to snow avalanches. Now here, you probably, if you look at the board, if you're going to go out and cross-country ski, the board is updated every day and gives the danger levels on the trails, the snow trails around here, if you're going to go out with skis or snowshoes. So you probably don't really need to worry. If you're going to go up Railroad Creek, there's some days you probably shouldn't go up Railroad Creek. And we'll talk about that. Okay. So, this was a huge avalanche event that occurred on the south side of Mount St. Helens, where the entire winter snow supply that was in the Shoestring Glacier released and went down 2 miles down the Lahar. There's chunks of snow as big as an automobile. You can see my pack and ski poles. A huge event, but 42% of avalanche fatalities are in avalanches that have run 300 feet or less. So small avalanches can be as deadly as one of these huge events. And avalanches, you think snow's fluffy and it won't hurt you? Well, when it comes down, it's heavy, very dense snow, and it can be very damaging. The Volkswagen Bug that was parked in the parking lot, you can break trees off the tree trunk. This is my favorite photo. It's a chunk of half-inch plywood where a fir limb was shoved right through the plywood. So you got a little bit of a feeling of the forces involved. This actually occurred not too far from here on the east side of Stevens Pass. If you came over from the west side on Stevens at a place called Yodlin, where back in the 70s, avalanche came down and damaged a number of cabins and 4 people were killed. So, and avalanches kill people. Willie Unsold, some of you might have heard of Willie. He's a well-known climber, climbed all over the world, and in, what was it, 1979, he died in an avalanche on Mount Rainier. So, avalanches kill people. You can see a little bit of who the victims are. This is last year's accidents. Backcountry skiers lead the pack. Sledders or snowmobilers are second. Snowshoers. Yeah, this is 2010 to 2013. Snowboarders are third in the group. And then we have climbers. It fluctuates from year to year. I think the year before, the sledders or the snowmobilers were involved in most of the fatal accidents. So, back to the checklist. I think, you know, checklists are important because you pull out the checklist, and it makes you pause before action. You've got to stop, pull out the checklist, makes you pause. So the stuff that's written on that checklist is useful, but maybe the pause is the most important. And last night in the film, if Sam and Blake had paused, maybe they'd be, or at least Blake would be here today. So, the checklist. Before you leave, on the checklist, there's certain things you should do before you leave. Here at the village, you need to sign up, sign the checkout sheet, where you're going, and then when you come back, you sign back in so that we don't start looking for you all over. Look at topog maps or guides of places you're going to go. I'm sure the library has maps and guides for the local area. And then check out the group you're going with. Is there a
Brian
in the group? And then there's things to do along the way. And again, these are things that are on the card. You know, look at snow conditions, look for clues, watch the weather. Of course, you should have gotten weather information and avalanche information before you left, and that was also posted on the bulletin board. Look at the terrain you're going to go into, watch the changing weather, and then when you're on the slope, how steep is the slope? Steepness is very important. You heard that in the film last night. We'll talk more about it. There's some little stability tests you can do, and we'll talk about those as well. So, we have terrain, we put snow on it, and the weather constantly changes the condition of that snow, and then the human factors interrelate with all those. So, let's look at human factors a little bit. Avoid the sheep, horse, lion syndrome. I didn't go over that, but what is the sheep syndrome?
You follow people?
Yeah, following. You know, following in a herd. And we tend to do that. We have comfort in following the group. But everyone in the group needs to be looking, watching, and communicating. So let's see, we might have Nancy. Nancy's the safety officer for the village. So we're going to go out, we want to go up Railroad Creek, and we want Nancy to take us because she's familiar with the area. And she probably can keep us from getting in trouble. But Nancy's been there 100 times before. And, you know, familiarity breeds complacency. And she might miss something that you pick up on because you're new. You hadn't been there before. And, oh, what's that? And Nancy just blew it. Went right by it. Follow me. So everyone in the group, all 4 of you are going to go out there. Everyone needs to communicate. You could establish a leader, not that guy. She'll be the leader. But, and then change, you know. Maybe you take a turn of leader. But everyone's communicating. And if someone has, you heard this in the film last night, but if someone in the group has some concerns, maybe that would be that's what you need to follow. You decide, I don't like the situation out here. You know, you can always go tomorrow. Okay? So, again, the sheep syndrome, that's the reason for the checklist. To remind you of things to check. Pilots use checklists. You know, it's very routine. They do it day in, day out. But they go through that checklist. Is the landing gear down? It's so routine, you forget things. Is the landing gear? It's pretty important that the landing gear is down. Okay. How about the horse syndrome? What's the horse syndrome?
Back to the barn.
Yes, good. So we're out there, we're cold, we're wet. Nancy says, let's go home. I'm cold. All we're thinking about is getting back to get some hot coffee or hot chocolate. So we decide, Nancy, let's take a shortcut so we get there faster. Well, that shortcut might be more dangerous than the longer way. Okay? How about the lion syndrome? Who do you think's the lion in the room?
Me.
No.
Brian.
You know, it's a pride, ego, summit fever. Gotta get to the summit. Gotta ski that, make those two extra turns in that powder that we haven't been in. So I always tell women when they're out there, if you're skiing with the boys, be cautious. Okay? And then there's the not me syndrome. It's always going to happen to someone else. It's not going to happen to me. And lastly, and I don't think we have anyone that fits this in the room, but the YMIS syndrome. So what's that? Young male's immortality syndrome. And these people go from feeling invincible to feeling immortal. Okay. We don't have anyone like that in here, right? Okay. I need to go backwards a little bit here to give you some percentages. 90% of those people that die in avalanches trigger the avalanche they die in. You can be in the 10% group. And the 10% group is you're going up railroad creek and a natural avalanche releases and picks you off, or you get hit by a roof avalanche. So that's the 10% group. You didn't start the avalanche, it was a natural release that you spent too much time in the wrong spot. 90% of avalanche accidents occur in the backcountry. 80 to 90% of avalanches released occur during storms and the first 12 to 24 hours after the storm. In the maritime climates which we're in, for the most part, after 12 to 24 hours, things begin to stabilize. But 64% of the accidents occur on blue sky days. So what's happening?
Sun is melting.
Yes, sun, yeah. We don't have many blue sky days in this country. And usually after a storm goes through, it clears up, so we all go out. And it's still within that 12 to 24 hour period. 70% of those people buried die. So what's the moral there? Make sure your friends know how to find you. 86% of those found within 15 minutes are alive. So again, make sure your friends know how to find you within 15 minutes. That wasn't enough time last night. 75%, and this is why I really told you that you don't know it, you don't won't know anything when you leave this room. 75% of the victims have had some training. They think they know more than they do. 75% of the victims died from asphyxiation. 24% died from trauma, and that's what happened last night. Blake died from trauma. He hit a tree. But most people die from being buried and not being able to breathe. Actually, our whole presentation is based on The rule of threes, the first rule, 3 minutes. You can only live 3 minutes without oxygen. And one 1% live long enough to die from hypothermia. Okay. So, avoid the sheep, horse line syndrome. Be careful of the adrenaline rush. That's what happened to them last night. They had that. They had to make a few more turns in untracked powder in the opening higher up on the ridge. Group programming. And what I mean by that is, let's see. Do we have anyone that flies airplanes in the room? No? Let's see. Looks like...
Only come to us.
What's your name?
Hans?
Hans?
Hans.
Hans. Okay, say Hans is he's a captain for United Airlines. He makes lots of money. And he's with your group. You know, you're out. And you get in a situation you don't know what to do. Who are you gonna go to? Hans. He's a guru. He's a, you know, captain flies those big airplanes. Probably doesn't have a clue about avalanches, but all of a sudden he feels, well, I gotta do something. I'm in charge all of a sudden. So watch out for guru programming. Eyes open. Sometimes there's things out there we can't see them because we think we will see everything out there, but in reality we see what we expect to see, want to see, or what we've seen before. So how many, and some of you already probably know this, how many see the arrow in FedEx? So some people don't. You see the arrow in FedEx? Yeah? See? You all see the arrow in FedEx? What happens is, more and more people are beginning to recognize it. The first few times I did this a few years ago, no one saw it. And we see the FedEx, not up here, but when we're in town, we see that FedEx truck every day going down the street. But we focus on the letters. I had at my office, which is Starbucks, I pull this on the guys that hang out at my table, and there's one guy that pointed to it. He could not see it. Because he kept trying to see it in the letters. So you follow what I'm trying to... Okay. When we're in groups, we tend to be bolder. If you go out alone, which you shouldn't, at least if I go out alone, which I shouldn't, I'm constantly looking, I'm constantly checking on conditions. I go much slower. But when I'm in a group, you all of a sudden feel, well, the group will keep me out of trouble. But again, the group, everyone in the group needs to be paying attention and looking and communicating. Cost-benefit, that's where we get in trouble. That's where they got in trouble last night. The benefit overpowered the cost of what happened last night. Minority opinions, we already talked about that. Pay attention to minority opinions. And pay attention to the person in the group with the least experience. Familiarity breeds complacency, we already talked about that. And finally, have you ever heard about Swiss cheese model? So, and this applies to nothing, not just snow, everything you do. In fact, the Swiss cheese model was developed for wildland firefighters. So, every time you do an unsafe act, it's a slice of Swiss cheese, okay? And you pile them on top of each other, each unsafe act, slice of Swiss cheese, and if the holes line up, there's going to be an accident. But, 99 times out of 100, or 999 times out of 1,000, you get by. It's the one time. So the more times you get by, after a while you don't even consider it to be an unsafe act. So how many of you have gone through yellow lights at traffic intersections? Yeah? How many over the speed limit a little bit? Yeah, see, we all do it. I do it myself. But I think about the Swiss cheese model. So just to... This is a true story, relates to the Swiss cheese model. This guy, every morning he drove down to an intersection, going to work. That intersection, there was a stop sign. He always turned right. And he did it for years. One morning he went down, it was foggy. He turned right, semi hit him. He was gone. He didn't stop. Okay? Oh, choice, not chance. Most avalanche accidents relate as choice, not chance, the reason for it happening. Okay, let's look at terrain. Is that steep slope a concern for avalanches? No, why? Why no? Snow keeps slopping?
Snow can't accumulate on it.
That's right. Right on. Exactly right. So, we need to put numbers on the slope. The areas of concern are between 30 and 45 degrees. You heard it last night in the film. 38 degrees is about optimum for avalanche release. The staircase that goes from the dining hall down, that's exactly 38 degrees. I measured it with a clinometer. So put numbers on the slope. You can buy a clinometer or you can buy a compass. Just a simple compass. Some of them have clinometers built in. There's various apps that have clinometers built in. You don't need to have cell service. See, it works fine. Right here. Anyhow, there's several clinometer apps that you can get. And if you're into that, we can do measure steepness of slope with ski pole. So I need someone to volunteer to be a slope. Would you like to be a slope? Slope?
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See,
okay. Yeah. We may slope together?
So, yeah. Okay, so you're a slope. You hold on. Okay. So, take your ski poles. And you put it sort of at the bottom of the slope. And it's about a 45 degree slope. Okay? Lower the slope a little bit. Three quarters of the way up the ski pole. Back up. That's about 37 degrees. And halfway is 27 degrees. So 27 degrees is below the most of the danger. 37 degrees is about a dangerous slope. So you can just use your ski poles to figure out steepness of slope. Thank you, slope. Thank you, slope. Slope should get a little prize. It's a spork.
That's a spork.
Well, I don't know. You. Mom gets the. Okay. Okay, follow. This is the area to be concerned. A lot of slopes as you go up Railroad Creek are that steepness. The slag pile up above is that steepness and more, right, Nancy?
Yeah, the big one's about 38 degrees.
Yeah. So if you're going to snowboard on that, pick the right day.
Well, it's got a lot of metal in it sticking up through the
snow. They've released, haven't they released avalanches on those?
Yeah.
Yeah. So right across from where we are. Okay. This is not too far from here as well. This is the west side of the Stevens Pass Highway. Did any of you come from the west side this way over Stevens Pass? Maybe?
Yeah.
Probably
stand up. Yeah.
So you went right by, look across. Significant avalanche paths.
Brian?
Said, Mr. M, you should go up right up the draw here because avalanche is already released. What Brian doesn't realize, it forks up here. One's released and the other one's waiting for Brian. So I probably, if I had to cross, go up, I think I'd go up through the trees. It's a little safer, okay? This is an interesting spot as well. Just off the photograph is the what's left of the old town of Wellington. And back in 1910, and if you're interested, maybe the books are in the library, some of those books about the 1910 railroad disaster. No? But anyhow, it's a fantastic story. But anyhow, train was going towards Seattle, got stopped by an avalanche, and spent several days sitting. Another avalanche came down and hit the train, and 96 people were killed. The worst avalanche disaster ever to happen in the United States, and it's really happened not too far from here. Okay, so we'll go on. I'm always interested, in fact, this is just up Railroad Creek near Lake, this photo. And I like to know what's underneath me. So I like to go to places in the summertime, so in the wintertime I know what's underneath. In this case, it's a smooth rock slope, so it doesn't take much snow for an avalanche incident to occur. But up here where there's trees act as anchors to hold the snow to the slope. Skier came down, actually released an avalanche, fell, and got up and survived, but he was very fortunate. A little bit about snow cover. There's two types of avalanches. There's loose snow avalanches, which you can see here. We often see them here on warm days on south-facing slopes or in the spring. They're relatively harmless unless you have a terrain trap below you, like a crick or a cliff or a crevasse or trees. As we found out last night, the trees that Blake and Sam were thrown into, those trees act as a terrain trap. So, relatively harmless unless you have a terrain trap below you. The ones that are scary are the slab avalanches. where a whole mass of snow releases at once. In this case, we knew this was a lead deposition slope, and we're going to talk more about that. We knew there was a weak layer in the snowpack. We skied to that point, made a sharp turn, and the avalanche released. But if we hadn't known that, we could have been crossing that slope and released the avalanche and be buried in the debris below. Where's the silly putty? Silly putty's well traveled. Thank you. Oh, it's nice. What's in there?
But don't open it. Oh.
Yeah. Don't open it. Please. It's just a little mermaid figurine.
Can we take it out?
No, yeah. Don't.
He has to do something special with it.
Okay. I'll let you put it back in. Okay. What I'm playing with here is silly putty. And silly putty has similar consistency as a snowpack. And it has a lot of built-in energy. See? Uh-oh. Yeah. So, see all that built-in energy? If you put moderate stress on it, it'll sort of stretch. And we see examples of this here in the village where the snow starts on the overhang of the roof and starts to hang over the edge of the roof. So the snow is under moderate stress. Friction is trying to hold it to the roof, but gravity is making it move. But if we put sudden stress on it, like
Ryan
jumping out of the slope, fracture. Okay, follow? Okay, you can add a silly putty pack. So what we have here is a slab of snow, which is a very dense mass of snow. We have a bed surface, and in between, we may have a weak layer. The weak layer can be an old rain crust, a sun crust, surface hoar. We heard about surface hoar last night. Surface hoar, and we see it out here. We didn't see it. I don't think I saw any this morning.
Yeah, there was.
There was? So we must have had some clearing during the night. It's just like dew at home, you know, in the summer. You have dew. It's frozen dew, essentially, surface hoar. And if it stays cold, that surface hoar can last for days and days and days, and it actually grows. And then if it snows on top, that ends up being the weak layer in the snowpack. It's deadly. Most of the fatal accidents in the United States are the result of that surface hoar layer. The problem is it's hard to see it out there because, you know, it forms overnight. You have to have a clear night, no wind. So the next morning, it's there. The sun hits the slope, the surface hoar disappears. But in the shaded areas, it remains. So then when you have snowfall, you don't know where the sunny areas were or where the shaded areas were. So that's the reason you got to do low stability tests when you're out on the snow. A storm of very low density snow can be a weak layer. So you have very dense snow, the bed surface is dense, and then you have a layer of very low density snow like you get in the Midwest. Very dry snow, and that's ends up being the weak layer in the snowpack. Okay, snowflakes fall, they round, and they connect, and they build strength in the snowpack. If you have rain, in fact, here in this country, if you have a rain event, be cautious if you're out there, because you can have immediate avalanche release if a rain event starts. is because of the sudden redistribution of stresses. So rain starts to melt the connection between the ice grains. It can refreeze and strengthen. Sunshine will do the same thing. In the spring, we have what we call corn snow. And it's the result of this melting and then refreezing. So a little bit about the weather. The weather reports are posted on the board, so check the weather. Just for a quick briefing on the weather, we've got 1 week system coming in today. We have another week system coming in tomorrow. A third week system coming in on Thursday. The weekend looks like a significant precipitation event, probably the strongest storm we've had here since September. But it looks like initially here at the village, it's going to be rain. Nancy and I will keep checking the models and see if there's any changes. But right now, it looks like rain. But eventually, the front will go through and the rain will change to snow. So, there's always weather. The Northwest Weather and Avalanche Center, which I helped establish, there's cards back here that give you the website. Of course, Nancy accesses every day. She posts the forecast. I won't. But there's a lot of things. The forecast that's produced, there's one forecaster forecasting for the entire Washington Cascades, the east side, the west side, the Olympics, and the Mount Hood area. One forecaster. So that forecast is very general. It's not site specific. It doesn't tell you what's out here. It gives you a general idea. So you have to make some of your own stability tests. And one thing to think about is the slopes we need to be concerned about are the lee slopes. The wind, it's the back side. So this is the ridge. The wind's blowing from this direction. And this is the yellow areas are the areas to be concerned. And that's where the skiers and the snowmobilers love that because that's new soft powder snow. It's not the wind-blown surface, but that's the dangerous slope. So here we have cross-ridge deposition. So each drainage, as we go up the valley, it's the east-facing side is the one that gets loaded. So if the drainage is here as you're going up the valley. It's this side is the one is in most cases would be the slope that's loaded that you should stay out off of. But it changes. It isn't always on the same side. So here, this is down at Mount Hood. The Mount Hood summit is there. Timberline Lodge is over here. You can see the slopes that normally avalanche release. They're the northeast facing slopes. But on this particular day, the winds are blowing from the northeast and picking up the snow on formerly the lee slopes and putting it on to formerly the windward slopes. So it changes. It isn't always. So you got to sort of figure out when you're out there which direction the snow is blowing. So there's clues. And here in this photo, there's no avalanche concern. It's flat. It's right next to the snow parking lot near the road. But there's a clue of which direction the wind was blowing from. So which direction was blowing from? Blowing from right to left or left to right? What?
Left to right.
Left to right? Right to left?
Right
to left?
Left to right.
Everyone agree or no?
Left to right. Left.
Right to left?
Right.
Right? Right?
Left to right.
You're right.
Left to right.
No, it's right to left. Sorry. So
wind is blowing from this direction, you can see the stump formed a little eddy and made this, I think the meteorologists call these snow scoops. I call them flags because they're super signals out there which way the wind was blowing. You'll see them all over. So, yes, you're right, right to left. Okay. So, no snow here, but temperatures are below freezing. This is huckleberry brush about a foot high. Temperatures are below freezing. So which way was wind blowing from?
Left to right.
Left to right?
Yeah.
Left to right?
Right to left, right to left.
What?
Right to left.
Right to left?
Left to right.
Right to left.
Right to left. Left to right.
Right to left.
Left to right? Left to right?
Left to
right. Right to left.
You're all wrong.
Right to left.
It's right to left.
No.
Why is it?
Ah. This is Rheim ice. It's temperature below freezing. It was foggy. Wind was blowing from this direction. The Rheim forms on the twig and grows towards the direction from which the wind is coming from. The same process of an airplane flying through a cloud below freezing, the Rheim will form on the front of the wing. In this case, the wing is standing still. Follow? In this country, we have lots of Rheim, where Midwest you don't see much Rheim. Here you do, lots of Rheim. Super clue of which way the wind was blowing from. Got it? I thought he had it right initially. No? Oh, someone up there did. Good job. Okay. Have any of you climbed Mount St. Helens? Aha.
Before it blew up.
When? After the eruption?
Before.
Oh, before. Oh,
before.
Yeah, I did it about 30 times before. And, I don't know, 5 times since. This was afterwards. Most climbers go up from the south side in the spring. Lots of climbers. In fact, on Mother's Day, everyone wears dresses climbing Mount St. Helens. And someone's going to get caught because this was an avalanche release. It was a natural release. Most climbers go up this ridge, Monitor Ridge, and they ski down or snowboard down. And I can't tell you which side to go down. You'd have to decide on that particular day. But the storm came in. Winds were from the west, so the east-facing slopes were the ones that were loaded, and those are the ones you don't want to be on. So, a little bit about equipment to take. I got to check. Okay. 3 pieces of equipment, 4 pieces of equipment you should take with you. One's an avalanche beacon, if you're going to go out on these steep slopes. And I think most of you, if you're going to go out, you're going to stay in the valley floor or ski in the trails around the village. So you don't need to be carrying an avalanche beacon. So you should carry a beacon. And what happens with these beacons, like this is on, you see the little blinker? It's on transmit mode. It's transmit. So I wear it inside my clothing. If I get buried, it sends out a signal, and the survivors will turn their beacons on, search, and find me. So the beacon helps you get to the general area where the person is buried. The protopole, the second piece of equipment you should carry, will help pinpoint, maybe faster than you can pinpoint with the beacon. And the third piece of equipment is a shovel, so you can dig the victim out. So, what's the fourth piece of equipment you should take with you?
Your brain.
What?
Your brain.
Good job. Where's, who's the brain? Who said brain?
Oh, thanks.
So throw it out in the group. And I want it back so I can finish my presentation. I can't, you know. Anyhow, brain. Thanks. Well, you can pass it around.
Oh.
I'll need it so I can find my way back to them. Okay, so there's a beacon buried in the room. We already have a volunteer who's going to search for the buried beacon. And the numbers get smaller as he gets closer, and the arrows will give him the direction of travel. And, you know, there's interference in here, so he might get astray a little bit because the computer, there's other things that might affect it. Any smaller?
No, it's seen this way.
See, what's confusing is that the signal doesn't go direct from the transmitting beacon. It goes on a flux line. So you might have to go sort of around in a circle. Not a complete circle, but a... Okay, let me see how he's doing. Six, 5.6, 5.4, 4.9, 3.8, 3.1, 2.5, 2.2, 1.9, these are meters, 1.3, 1.2. There it is. So he should get a prize. That other prize was for Mom.
Hello, take it out.
Oh, don't worry about it. So, how about Smokey Bear bandana? It matches your outfit.
No.
I'm sure you're excited about it. There. Okay. So.
Let me show you.
I take some other gadgets with me, but those are the four pieces of equipment that are really critical to take. Maybe you've seen photos of these airbags that some of the backcountry skiers are carrying now. So they pull the cord and this balloon pops up out of the bag. I say, yeah, take all the safety gear, but face your decisions on not having any of that stuff with you. You shouldn't let having the safety gear influence you on your decisions out there. Oh, because I got a beacon, I can ski that slope that maybe is dangerous. Okay? All right. There's various beacons out there. Four or five manufacturers, they're all on the same frequency, whether you buy one in New Zealand or Switzerland or in Chicago. All on the same frequency. If you wear the beacon, very cool photo. He's wearing the beacon, but he is wearing it in one way properly because the face of the beacon should be towards your body. But you should wear it inside your clothing, not on the outside. So if you get caught in an avalanche, it could easily be ripped off because it's on your outside of your clothing. So wear it inside your clothing. You can use this these gear to do other things with. I like use your ski pole or your probe to poke holes in the snow. You can get a feeling of a rain crust or sun crust by poking the snow. If there's a layer of a foot of very low density snow, and you push a pole down and it drops a foot, well, there's a significant weakness in the snowpack. And you can use them to do stability tests. And what we're going to do, we're going to demonstrate the stability test, and then we'll be done for the afternoon. Okay? So, I need I need one woman initially to be a snow cow. So, we'll get out in front. There's three different stability tests to do, and or I'll demonstrate three different stability tests. But one of them is the shovel shear, the second one is the shovel compression test, and the third one is the extended column test. The extended column gives you all the information. And that's only, if you're out there, that's the only one you really need to do. But I'll demonstrate the three of them. And somehow or other, I've left my saw behind. So, improvise. This is a snow saw. So, we have snow, you know, just a slope of snow. We want to make a 4-foot wall. So, with my shovel, So I got a 4-foot wall. I know you're taller.
Barely.
And now for the shovel shear test, I'm going to partially isolate a column that's going to be 30 centimeter by 30 centimeter. Remember, I'm not going to get out there with a ruler and measure. This is, I'll just put this down on the snow. That's my 30 by 30 centimeter column. So, pop. So I got the arc. So, sawing. And then the back side, I'll just go down far enough about the length of my saw. Okay? And what this is going to tell me, is there a weakness in the snowpack? Is there a weak layer in the snowpack? I might take a card once I've exposed this wall, and I can pick up some of the weak layers with the card, or some of the sun crust, rain crust, that gives me information. So, then I put the shovel in the back, down the back side, and then I'm not gonna reef on it, I'm gonna sort of pull on the shovel. And if I have a fracture, there's where the weak layer exists. Okay? Thank you, snow calm, but remain. Okay. So now I'm going to demonstrate the shovel compression. Same scenario, we want a 4-foot column, so we've cleared the 4-foot wall, and we've isolated the sides, and in the compression test, we isolate the backside all the way down. In past classes, we go out and do this, but we don't have enough snow to do it. Okay, so The column is isolated. It's no longer attached to the rest of the snowpack. So it's under stress. And if it fractures without me putting any more stress on it, condition is pretty unstable out there. But it didn't. So remember 30 centimeter by 30 centimeter column. I put the shovel on top of the column, and then I lay my arm on the handle, and then I do 10 taps from the wrist. One, two, three. You see we're putting stress on that column? Four. If we have failure from 1 to 10, you know, conditions are pretty touchy out there. What this is simulating is me going out on my skis on the slope. When I go out on the snow, on my skis or snowshoes, I'm putting stress on the snowpack. So what we're simulating is this, but in a minute version. Okay, so we go 10, and then the next level of stress is from the elbow. So we see we're putting additional stress on the column. If we have failure, moderately unstable. If not, and I won't do this, then we do 10 taps from the shoulder. And we keep track, 1 through 30. Okay. Thank you, Snow Calm, but remain. I need two more victims. Okay. Well, I usually don't have guys, but we'll let you in. Okay, so this is the extended column. Extended column is handled exactly the same way. We clear the 4-foot wall, we have a 90 centimeters across. I know it's a little more than that. 90 centimeters across. And I use a marking. Again, I'm not very precise. I'll just go, and that's my 90 centimeter length, okay? It's marked on the snow. And then I'm gonna isolate, just like we did for the shovel compression. And then we go down the back side. I actually, if I had my saw, I have a way I can hook it onto my ski pole, so I have a long handle for the saw, so I can actually saw on the back. Okay, so we have it, the column isolated. Again, same thing, if we have failure, conditions are pretty unstable because the column is no longer attached to the rest of the snow column, or the rest of the snowpack, so immediately it's under stress. If we have failure, I'd be really concerned about conditions. If not, I'll go on the other side this time. We're going to do exactly the same thing. It doesn't matter. You can do it from one end or the other. And we're going to do the same thing. One, two, three. And if we have failure, and then it propagates across, we're getting additional information. We found out we have a weak layer. We had failure, and it propagated. So it simulated the slab avalanche release you saw in the photograph. Are you following? Mm-hmm. Very simple test. Yes?
Should you cut this going downhill? Are we going downhill?
Oh, yes. Are we doing this on a downhill slope? It really doesn't matter where you do it. You don't do it out in the middle of an avalanche path. You do it in a safe location. It can be on the flat ground. It can be just on a very 20 degree, 15 degree slope away from runout zones of avalanches. So it doesn't matter. You could do it on a little downhill if you want to. You could do it on uphill, just as long as you aren't on the 30 to 45 degree slope. Okay? So, and, so, again, it identifies where the weakness is in the snowpack. It shows that the weakness fails, and then the additional information this does, it tells us that the failure is going to propagate across the slope and will identify what a slab avalanche would do. Okay? Thank you, Snow Slopes. Get prizes, too. You get the bandana because you got most of the heat. So
you thank you.
And then a couple more sparks. So thanks to the snow columns. Let's break for the day, because I think some people have to do something before it gets dark. Any questions? There's, like I said, pick up the handouts if you want to. I have a sign-up list if you're interested in getting additional information when you get home. So sign out if you wish. If you're interested in any publications, one of the best ones is Snow Sense. If we see the film tomorrow night, we'll see the authors of this book in the film. Another one that's a sort of a classic is the ABCs of Avalanche Safety. It was originally written by Ed LaChapelle. He really is the father of avalanche research and studies in the United States. He's no longer with us. And it was the most recent edition was edited by Sue Ferguson, who is a very great friend of mine. She was one of the forecasters at the Avalanche Center years ago, and a number of years ago she died of breast cancer. So neither of them are with us anymore. And I think both of these are in the library, I believe. Okay. Any other questions? You see me around. You can ask questions.
I have a question.
You got a question.
What's that doll doing that right there?
I have a question. What does all the ice that's on the ground now do? I mean, I guess it's there's so little snow underneath it, but if there's...
You got ice and, it's another layer of, potentially it's another layer in the snowpack that's somewhere else that's a weakness. It's a result of freezing rain. Did you have a freezing rain event here?
So yeah, we had a lot of rain.
You've had rain and it refroze. And possibly there's some layers, higher elevation of that freezing layer. So that's, the freezing rain layer. And that's potentially a weakness in the snowpack as well. How it formed was the grain and then froze. Okay.
How many inches of snow do we need to get before we should be concerned about rough lanches and avalanches?
It depends where you are. Okay. If you're on a slope that, like that one photo, if you're on a slope that has lots of anchors, I mean, you have 3 or 4 feet until those anchors are completely covered, then you may have some concern, because then the layers, there's nothing holding the snow. If you have a very smooth surface,
like a roof,
a few inches, I don't know, you have a foot of snow on the roof, you've got concerns, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
but 6 inches or 6 inches still?
Yeah, well, I'd still be concerned about 6 inches.
Yeah.
So, what I'm concerned about here is The village does a fantastic job. You heard the safety presentations as you came in the village. When they have concerns about the roof avalanches, they put up ropes around the edge, around the buildings, right?
Well, we close the road if this building is, we think it's a danger. We reroute the winter paths so that they don't go into the roof zones.
Yeah. What I'm most worried about is a little guy like this maybe doesn't always listen to his mom. And, you know, it gets too close to the building. So, you know, you're going to be here for quite a while. If you see some kids playing when there's, you know, a foot or 2 foot of snow on the roof close to the building, you need to tell them to move away. Okay, any other questions? Yes?
So, should we call that guy, he like held onto the tree, is that actually a good decision?
The question, Blake held on to the tree last
Sam.
In the film last night. And Sam did too. Yeah. Well, Sam did. Yeah, that was it, Sam. So, I'm caught in an avalanche, and I think I try to grab something, and hopefully the avalanche continues on, and I'm left there just hanging on to the tree. I think he did the right thing, except he got banged up by against another tree. He was in a group of trees and he held on to one, but I think he got banged up against another tree and that's what did his damage. I would try to grab onto something. He's alive. He might not have been if he hadn't grabbed on the tree. He might have been buried and suffocated. So I'd grab onto the tree. I'd try to grab it. We'll talk about that when we get into people getting caught and what to do.
Does this information generally apply to slopes around the world where there's snow?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Same percentage. 30% to 45%. I was in International Snow Science Workshop in Grenoble here middle of October, and they were using exactly the same percentages. Yes?
Sometimes in popular movies you see avalanches created because someone was talking too loud or shouting or something.
Yeah.
Does that really happen?
That's a myth.
Okay.
They've actually done, the question was, we've seen it in movies where people were talking too loud that caused the avalanche. It's a myth. They actually did, many years ago in Colorado, they did sonic boom tests where they had jets flying up the valleys, snow-covered valleys in sensitive snow conditions. No avalanche release. It's more putting stress onto the snow that releases the avalanche. And the stress can be additional snowfall. It don't have to be
Brian.
It could be additional snowfall. It can be rain. It can be snow falling off a tree. It could be wildlife out there, but not sound. Any other questions? Okay, class dismissed.